All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Brian McCullough. Steve Kirsch is one of the more fascinating entrepreneurs we've been lucky enough to speak to on this show. Going all the way back to the 1980s, he was the inventor of the optical mouse. And back in the days of desktop software suites, he brought FrameMaker to the world. He also founded Abaca Technology, the spam filter company, and OneID. Today, he's the founder and CEO of a really interesting new startup that he'll tell us about called Token. But of course, we wanted to speak to him mostly about the founding of the search engine and web portal InfoSeek. Steve recounts for us how InfoSeek was born and thrived during the dot-com era, and gives us the outline of his career in one of the more comprehensive conversations we've been able to have with a truly serial web entrepreneur. Small bit of housekeeping here, real quick. As you know, I attempt to get new episodes out every Monday, but occasionally the company I own demands a bit more of my time than usual, and this project is forced to take a temporary backseat. Next week will be one of those times, as I expect to be on the road Detroit and other places, so there will be no episode next week. The next new episode will be March 30th, so mark your calendars. In the meantime, please enjoy this great chat with InfoSeek founder Steve Kirsch. Steve Kirsch, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
Great to be here.
I always delve a little bit into people's education and background, and a lot of the people that we talk to get an early start in tech, and boy, definitely you did too. How did you find yourself in the computer room at UCLA in 1969, right around the birth of ARPANET?
Well, I lived very close to UCLA, and I had been exposed to computers at a very young age, since the sixth grade in elementary school. And so I was always looking for opportunities to learn more about computers that were closer to home. And, I just happened to be in the right place at the right time, that UCLA was a short bike ride away, and they had people that had computers and were doing interesting things. And, I just happened to be wandering around and hooked up with the right people. So it's a lot of it's by chance.
So you're just a precocious kid that wants to get to where the computers are at, and you just sort of introduce yourself, I guess.
Yeah. It's like, looking for bigger computers than what I was working on previously. And, where's the closest bigger computers? And, yeah, they were at UCLA. And so, yeah, it was just really just luck. It was, I did not do any research about the ARPANET or anything like that. It was just like, hey, where's the next biggest computer?
But you do befriend some of the people that are involved in the starting of ARPANET, including Vint Cerf, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No. So I worked on the third floor of Belter Hall and at UCLA, and I got to know all the people there, and they were actually very friendly and tolerant of a young junior high school kid wanting to learn more about computers. And, you know, so it was mutually beneficial that I would work, because I tended to work in the off hours. So I would work like, you know, 3 a.m. in the morning or and the reason for that is, well, there were incentives. So if I worked at when other people weren't at work, then I got to use the data point terminals. And these data point terminals were running at 2400 baud. And to me, that was like, wow, that's like dying and going to heaven. And there were these were CRT terminals. Mm-hmm. And if I try to use things during the day, the all of the terminals are so busy with the people who are hired to do this stuff that the only ones that were available for me to use were the Model 33 ASR teletypes. And those things ran at, you know, 110 baud or 300 baud. Those things are just super, super slow, and they're, you know, typing on paper, and it was just not a fun environment. And so that's why I chose to work at night, where I could work at 2400 baud on a CRT terminal. Way more cool.
Well, and when you say work, I mean, they're letting you work on some projects that the larger group is working on. Like, don't you write one of the first messaging programs or almost like an email client for the time?
Yeah. Yeah. So I wrote an email application. It was not an internet email application because the internet didn't exist at that point. It was an application that ran on the Xerox Sigma 7, and that allowed the team members to communicate with each other over email. But it was a local email. It was a mail that you would send messages to other people on the system rather than to someone else on the internet.
And I read, this is neither here nor there, but I read that you also had a job repairing pinball machines at the time.
One of my summer jobs. I got a job repairing pinball machines, and that's because it paid $45 an hour. And as a high school student, I didn't find any other jobs that would pay more than $45 an hour. And I had experience. It makes sense. I had experience in fixing pinball machines because my father bought a pinball machine and it was constantly breaking. And so I kind of said, well, this is interesting. I wonder how you fix this. And sort of learned how pinball machines worked, and you know, it ended up being a pretty good deal because you could earn a lot of money in a very short amount of time. And the places that ran the pinball machines were happy to pay me $45 an hour because the alternative was to pay the professionals who were charging, you know, $60 an hour. So, you know, it worked out well for me, and it worked out well for the for my employer.
You end up going to MIT. Was that did Vint Cerf suggest that to you? Talking to MIT.
Yeah, it was Vint. I said, I went to Vint, and I said, so where do you think I should go to college? I'm really interested in computers. And he said, well, you could go to MIT, Caltech, or Carnegie Mellon. Those were the big places at the time.
So I'm not sure on the chronology of this. So correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe, when you're at MIT, you're doing a lot of programming in Lisp. And Lisp, for those that wouldn't know or wouldn't remember, the input, one of the input devices were early mice, mouses. So you're at this point where not a lot of people are using mice with computers. You are. And it occurs to you that there could be a better way than the mechanical ball mice of the time, and so you you knock together and invent the first optical mouse.
Yeah, that's right. So the Lisp machines were using mice made by a guy named Hawley, who developed mechanical mice and for Xerox. And those were the kind of the only mice that you could get. But the problem is they kept getting clogged, and you know, you'd roll them and sideways, and the mouse wouldn't track it because the tracking mechanism got stalled or the ball wasn't rolling in its casing and so forth. And so I thought, you know, this is kind of a waste because the Liss machines were $200,000 machines, and you couldn't use them. The keyboards were great. We had Cherry keyboards, which were just awesome. But the mice were horrible. And so I thought, well, you know, there's got to be a better way to do this. And if we can get rid of the moving parts, we'd have a much more reliable tracking mechanism than the ball mice. And these were using metal balls at the time rather than rubber balls that the you know, newer mice use that were invented since then. And so so I came up with a way to use a checkerboard pattern and a four-quadrant optical sensor, and it could then determine very accurately which way you were going. And that subsequently got refined to use multicolors so that there were two colors of lines. And so I had I was able to create a pattern where inks were printed in infrared such that they would be I had an infrared LED and a red LED, and I had lines on the paper, and the lines were such that under the infrared LED, you'd see the horizontal lines, and under the red LED, you'd see vertical lines. And so I took a very difficult problem and just broke it down into two really easy problems to solve. And so I just alternated lights, which would then expose a set of lights. And then I had a four-quadrant optical detector in both directions. And the reason for the four quadrants is because I could then work them in differential mode, and that allowed me to avoid any sort of calibration of levels, you know, because it would just use the it would take the signal from one and subtract it from the signal of the other one, which was designed to be 180 degrees out of phase based on the line spacing and the spacing of the sensors. And so that was the design. It was the initial design was a checkerboard one, and then we went to the two different lines with different colors. And so that was the sort of the first version of the optical mouse. And it was such a simple technology. It could be implemented with a very simple programmable computers that you had at the time. So we had, you know, pretty basic chips that you could program in assembly language to go and do all the logic required to count the lines and to present an RS-232 interface out of that that could then be plugged into a computer and interpreted. And so that all worked. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, putting together the idea, putting together the hardware to do it, and then programming the computer to do that.
So you do start to shop it around to the computer makers at the time to see if they want to license it, and like you even take it to Apple at some point.
Yeah, so I got an appointment from some friends of mine. So I got an appointment to see Steve Jobs. And so the I got notice that, yeah, you could meet with him. And I think I had like 3 weeks. And at the time, I hadn't built anything. So I had to build all the hardware and write all the software in 3 weeks while being a student at MIT and not failing any of my classes. So that ended up being quite a challenge. especially since I had to, you know, learn a lot of things to be able to do that. But I did have some help from people, and we were able to put it together in time for the demo, and it worked great. And then Steve Jobs looked at it and he said, "Well, you know, great concept, you know, love it, but you need to lose the pad." And I'm like going, "Yeah. Wow, you know, so close, but so far, because how do I do this without a pad?" And so I didn't think at the time about the, you know, looking at the microstructure of surfaces as a way to detect motion, and that required more sophistication in terms of what I was able to do with just simple logic gates and so forth. So, things just went forward from that, and the design got refined over time, and sort of the rest is history.
Right, and I know this is skimming ahead slightly, but you eventually do create a company called Mouse Systems Corporation to market your mice, and that was your first sort of successful startup, I would say.
Yeah, I out of MIT, I took a job as a software engineer for Rome Corporation, doing office automation software.
Right.
We were using Convergent Technologies workstations. And and at night I would moonlight on the mouse idea and try to refine that. And eventually I quit my job and did Mouse Systems full time. And so we then started producing these things commercially. We created an interface so it would work on the PCs, so you could use it with spreadsheets like Lotus 1-2-3. Was around at the time, so it was really cool to be able to use the mouse to navigate your spreadsheets rather than have to hit the
arrow keys
constantly. And so that was a big hit. Sun Microsystems was building a workstation. They needed a mouse, and they didn't like mechanical mice, so they gave us some big orders, and so that was just really helpful in getting the company off the ground.
And rolling up the success of that company sort of leads you to your next company a few years later, which would be called Frame Technology Corp. But it was a company that you seed founded to essentially develop and market software that someone else created, which was the FrameMaker, the publishing software called FrameMaker. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. When I was at Mouse Systems, because we sold to Sun Microsystems, I got to know a guy named John Gage, who was their chief science officer, and John was always into doing crazy things. John was quite eclectic in his interests. And we were talking one day and he said, "Hey, I ran into this young guy, Charles Corfield, and he has the beginnings of what might be a competitor to Interleaf. And he's just this super smart kid, and I think you should meet with him." And so I followed John's advice, and I met with Charles, and I was impressed by what he did, and I thought, this has potential, and I said, "Hey, why don't we get together, start a company? I can hire some other people that I worked with at Mouse Systems or that I ran into, and I think we can make a go at this." And so eventually we became a huge competitor to Interleaf as a little startup company, and we got a lot of lucky breaks from Digital Equipment Corporation helping to fund us, and Toshiba Corporation was helped to fund us as well. And so without really any venture capital financing or not a heck of a lot of business experience, we created a company which eventually got acquired by Adobe Systems for $500 million.
Right, which brings us to what I'm interested in talking about, which is the idea that starts to form in your head around search. But it wasn't internet search. You were messing around with CD-ROMs at the time, and CD-ROMs of like a magazine catalog that had a search function, right?
Yeah, that was computer. It's called Computer Library. And it was a CD-ROM, and you had somewhere around 100 or so, might have been more, computer publications that were, a lot of them were Ziff Davis computer publications that were put on a CD-ROM. And the beauty of this is that you could stick the CD-ROM into your computer, you could type a few search terms, and in just seconds, you would get all the articles that were relevant to that search. And it was just an amazing experience. And the great thing is that even though we had systems like Dialogue was big back then, but the problem with Dialogue is that it was super expensive. You know, a search would cost $2 or $3 to find something, and that sort of price penalty to do the search, you know, a $3 search, and then you were paying $5 for the article, and it just got really expensive really fast. Whereas the beauty of Computer Library, it was a fixed-priced subscription, and you could search as many times as you want. You could find as many articles as you want. You could read as much as you want, and you just paid that one fixed price. And so I thought, wow, this is a great concept, and wouldn't it be great if we could make this available to people on the internet, and make it available at super low cost, because we could, the volumes would be much higher. And so the initial idea behind InfoSeek was to do what Dialogue did, but do it at a much grander scale and at much lower cost. And so it was originally a sort of fee for service. You would pay, we would give you like 10 free hits or whatever, but you'd have to pay for if you went beyond that. And so it was a little while later that we discovered that it was much better to give people free results and to use that as a traffic magnet and then charge for advertising.
Right, because let's frame the timeline here. This is 1993 that you start InfoSeek, right?
That sounds about right.
Okay, so this is, I mean, the web exists, but it's not even what the web it blows up to become in 1994, 1995. So what the search initially is people are searching for what?
Well, it's when we created InfoSeek, Mosaic was the big browser at the mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. And of course that's turned into, you know, Mozilla and Mosaic guys, you know, essentially started Netscape, and so it turned into Netscape, you know, which eventually turned into Mozilla. So we were the primary search engine. We ended up being the primary search engine for Netscape, and that drove a ton of traffic our way, because people wanted to search the net. And so we actually started off by focusing on computer publications, and that wasn't too fruitful, and we thought, okay, we'll do this internet search thing as a sideline, and it very quickly became our main line of business that people were much more interested in searching the net and finding things on the net, and that we could help with that rather than searching computer publications.
Right. And when you start InfoSeek, you're starting it with your own money this time from the previous companies succeeding, right?
Yeah. And we got venture money early on from a number of investors. And so that really helped in terms of being able to start up the company.
When you do pivot to, okay, the web is really where this business should be, this idea of search and things like that. What are the competitors at the time? Has Excite launched? I know that Yahoo was probably launched, but that was more of a directory than a search engine. So who would you look at as your competitors in that space?
When we first started, Lycos was there. And there were some like Metacrawler, I think, might have been in existence, or, you know, was there soon after. And then Excite came on a bit later, and AltaVista came on a bit later. So we were really there were a few alternatives for search, but we were... you know, Lycos would probably be the biggest competitor at the time.
When you mentioned that you pivot to, okay, the web search is going to be where it's at. Is it because of the volume? Is it because of the web exploding?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, when we got the deal to be, when you hit the net search button on Netscape, at mm-hmm. first they were just listing all of the search engines, and then we paid them a ton of money, and you hit net search and you would get our search engine as the sort of the top of page for that. And that was just driving a ton of page views and a ton of revenue for us.
And the revenue, you mentioned that originally your idea was to do some sort of, you know, pay per search or subscription model. But so when do you make the pivot to advertising supported?
It didn't take too long for us to figure out that it would be much better to do the advertising support. You know, at first we were giving people, hey, here are 10 free search results, and if you want more, then here's how to pay for it. And so it went from that. We hired a guy from Wired Magazine, and his name is Bill Peck. And Bill was a big help in terms of our drive to the cost per click and what we charge per 1,000 impressions. And, you know, so he would be selling on impressions. So we would say, hey, you would get, it would be 10 cents per 1,000 or whatever. And we also developed the banner ads. And so we created a reasonable size for the banner ads and got everybody to standardize on, hey, this is the size of the banners that we run, and that you could put any content you wanted in that, like animated GIFs and so forth. But you had to stick to that size. So the first ads that we had were banner ads, and we tied the banner ads to keywords. And that's kind of how it began.
There's a lot of other innovations that InfoSeek was responsible for. I mean, you guys had tons of interesting patents, like, even counting clicks on webpage advertisements, distributed search techniques and things like that. Did you guys ever actually... You only had those patents defensively. You never actually exploited those patents, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, a combination of two things. One is defensive, but I would say it's more to for a competitive edge, so that if we had the patent on this, then a competitor couldn't duplicate that. And so that was the more valuable thing, was sort of a underlying threat of litigation than any real litigation, because nobody really violated any of our patents.
So what's your role in the company? Are you ever the CEO of InfoSeek, or are you basically the technologist and the idea guy?
No, I was the CEO for quite some time at all the companies that I've mm-hmm. That I have founded.
But at some point, you hire outside people. You bring in CEOs to try to
ramp up the business,
right? And I've read that maybe you feel like some of those people weren't the right people.
Hiring is always a tricky thing, and I hired some good people and I hired some bad people. And I think that's been true throughout my career. And, you know, we'd love to only hire great people that that work out spectacularly well throughout the life of the company. And, you know, you make some mistakes along the way, but you try to recognize that you made a mistake and fix it and move on. And sometimes that's hard to do, that you may recognize that you made a mistake and the board doesn't. I think typically boards of directors of startup companies are very slow to slower than they should be to make a change in the CEO, because that's the number one job of the board, is to hire and fire the CEO. And I think that boards in general, the big mistake I've seen is not pulling the trigger fast enough when you have the wrong guy in place. And but you don't want a board to be trigger happy either. So it's a delicate mix, but in general, I've found that there are a lot of VC firms that are not good at basically recognizing that they made a mistake when they approved the hiring of a CEO and have been too slow to correct that error.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Mm-hmm. And one of the questions that I've spoken to, you know, Bob Davis of Lycos and George Bell of Excite, and I'll grant you that it's easy for me to ask this question in retrospect, but is it possible that one of the mistakes strategically that was made was this whole move towards becoming a portal that basically all of the search engines did in the later 90s? The idea being that would take your focus off of search as your core product.
No, I live this.
Right.
So I was much more of the opinion that we should do the best. We should stick to the knitting and do the best search engine that we could possibly do. And we should be, you know, it's much more the Google philosophy of, hey, let's index the entire web. And it's really important that people be able to find anything they want. And what was interesting is they got a lot of pushback from the product managers saying, well, there are only 10 million interesting pages on the web and nobody really needs to look at more than that. And we should just spend our time indexing the most relevant, interesting 10 million pages on the web. And that will provide a lot of value because then people don't have to sort through crap on their searches and it'll be fast. And we'll check that box. And that if we really want to expand our market, that we should do things other than search. And so that was the thinking at the time. My gut feel was that was a mistake, that we should be the biggest, fastest, largest, and do a kick-ass job at search. And other people disagreed. And so that's the reason that we got into this portal thing. And if you look at a company like Yahoo, they were extremely successful in expanding their directory and doing more than just directory. And so that was kind of like a success case that we could look at and emulate. That's why we went in that particular direction.
Right. I'm glad you brought up Yahoo, because even though obviously we're thinking of Google when we're looking back at this retrospectively, but at the time it was Yahoo that sort of was the king of the hill amongst the five or six major search engines or search sites, we should say. What do you, at the time or even now, what would you place their success to? Was it branding? Was it I don't know, the image, the friendliness, what do you think it was that made Yahoo rise to the head of that pack?
Well, being there first helped a lot. People didn't have a way to browse the internet to find out what's out there. And so Yahoo was out there as a directory that people could use. And they did a good job executing it. It was fast. It was simple. It was easy to use. It had a lot of good information and it was being expanded by editors. And it was useful. And so they did a lot of things right. Part of it is being lucky, being in the right place at the right time. And part of it is having a great product that was simple and easy to use and provided a lot of utility for people. So, they did really well in their space and we did well in our space.
And InfoSeek, eventually is purchased by Disney and becomes part of their go.com strategy or their go.com portal, I should say. What was the decision to sell to Disney? Was it just that the money was so big, or was that you felt like if you could get a company with that level of resources behind what InfoSeek was doing, that maybe you could take it to the next level?
Yeah, it was basically a way to say, hey, we can get access to more stuff. That Disney had a lot of content sites. You know, Disney had acquired ESPN. It was Starwave that they acquired. And Starwave provided the technology behind some services like ESPN and so forth. And so Disney had other assets as well, you know, proprietary content and so forth. And so the thinking was that, you know, they came to us and they wanted to buy the company because Disney wanted to create a web presence for themselves. And we looked at it as, wow, you know, this is a pretty attractive offer compared to our, you know, public valuation. And as, the board has a fiduciary responsibility to shareholders to look at any offers that are out there. And, you know, this seemed attractive in a way for us to move the company forward and create a more compelling offering or more extensive offering to our customer base.
As I mentioned, I've spoken to several other early search CEOs, and I've asked them the same question, which is, could you imagine a different world where, in your case, InfoSeek specifically had maybe remained independent and could have become a strong competitor to Google or what Google eventually became?
Had we turned them down, could that have happened?
Right.
Yes, it could have happened. I think it would be less likely to happen because there wasn't the focus on search that there was on Google. And I think that, in retrospect, it was a mistake for me to have said, you know, hey, you guys should go with my gut feeling as opposed to your, you know, logical argument that we should, you know, de-emphasize search. And so, I think that was a strategic mistake that probably wouldn't have been reversed if we had turned down the offer from Disney. And so I think that, it's just really, really important to, rather than look at sort of make logical arguments, the more important thing is really to listen to your customers and understand what your customers are asking you for and what they want. And we knew early on that the two biggest things in a customer's mind when they use a search engine is the two things are it's fast and it finds what you want. And in order to do, we were certainly fast, but if you're only indexing 10 million pages, it's not going to find what you want, right? Because there's a huge long tail of information. And, anytime you deviate from that, listen to your customers and make sure you're always exceeding customer expectations. That's when you can run into trouble, especially if you have a competitor that pops up with better technology.
Now, again, a lot of people that I talk to on this show are serial entrepreneurs, but I feel like almost you more so than most, because, I mean, you've been starting companies going back to 1982. And after the InfoSeek sale, I think you stay at Disney a little while, but you're already on to other companies like Propel. Is it Abaca, which does the spam filter software, right?
Yep.
And today you're with 1ID?
Yeah, and I started another company after that called Token.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about Token.
Well, Token is all about fixing the problem with payments. Because, you know, our most modern payment rail is the ACH system. And mm-hmm. it turns out it's not credit cards. It's actually the ACH system. And that moves $40 trillion a year. And so most of the money is used, and most of the money in America is moved through ACH. And what's remarkable is that the technology has not changed significantly at all in four decades. And so I've done an ACH transaction where it took 11 days to move 10 cents from one bank account at Wells Fargo to another one of my bank accounts at Wells Fargo. 11 days is a long time mm-hmm. to move 10 cents. And there are other things as well. You know, with credit cards, we're always seeing credit card breaches, and Apple Pay, of course, there are issues with the security in that. And, you know, there are just lots of, and there are break-ins where credit card numbers are exposed and people's identities are exposed and so forth. And so, we've been using really very, very old technology in order to move value. And value in most cases is money, but so we think of it as payments, and we've been using old technology to do that. We've been using very old paradigms for that as well. You know, credit cards are very, very old, and, you know, it's based on sort of 50-year-old shared secret technology that nobody's supposed to know my credit card number except for the person I give it to, and they're supposed to forget it as soon as I give it to them. And, you know, the world has moved on, and the attackers that are trying to steal money from the systems, and they do a pretty good job. The Apple Pay rates, the fraud rates are 6 or 7% for some vendors. And Apple Pay, you know, they spend a lot of time, on the security aspects of that. But so there, the point is that the attackers are always out there, and because we're using, you know, these payment rails that were put in, 50 years ago, that fundamentally haven't changed that much. I mean, there've been some incremental improvements, especially in the credit card area, but much less so in the ACH area. And so basically we have a pretty old antiquated system based on really old technology, and the people that are trying to exploit these systems are using the latest and greatest tools. And so it's just really time that we updated, how we move money, and we rethink the paradigms, that we use to move money. And that's what Token is all about, is in saying, look, there's a better way to do this. That where we can leverage secure identity, that we can leverage trustable federated identity, that we can leverage digital signatures, we could leverage autonomous digital agents that are working for us and so forth. And so we can take this very simple thing of, hey, can you pay me $5 a request? And we can handle that in a completely new, cool, slick way that gives us a lot of flexibility and, you know, open architectures and digital signatures and all sorts of things that give us a lot of flexibility for how we can go and respond to that request. And so Token is all about enabling a new infrastructure so that we can have a payment system which is really like modern age, you know, way better than anything we've ever seen before. And so I'm being a little bit cautious in terms of, I'm not trying to reveal everything about how it works, but it's, you know, other than it's, yeah, it'll be a game changing thing, I think, for payments. And, you know, I tell people, look, this is the future of money. And if that sounds pretty grandiose and so forth, but I can tell you that the people that we disclose this to, they say, yeah, this is really cool. This is really big. This is impressive, you know, and all that stuff. And so, so that's what I'm involved in now is changing, the way that, that people get paid.
Well, let me just ask one question about that. Hopefully this is broad enough that you can answer. Is the idea to bring the banks on board with this system, or is this to create a whole new system outside of the banks?
No, it's a little bit of both in that the system is agnostic in terms of where your assets are. And so you can have your assets in a bank, or you can have your assets in a virtual currency, and we're agnostic to that. But we do that, but the whole system is designed to be compatible and compliant with rules and regulations of nations and states that regulate the flow of money. And so, unlike Bitcoin, which was kind of designed in spite of regulation, we were designed to be totally compliant with regulations, because I have no interest in going to jail. I have no interest in creating things which are illegal or might be illegal. That's just not. I just don't think that's a very productive thing to do. Nor do I think that that's a. It's not a productive thing to do for the consumer, and it's not a productive thing to do for the country either, because the regulations are designed to protect consumers, and they're also designed to guard against money laundering. And so, you know, those are things that we'd like to do and we'd like to comply with.
Steve, if I could close by asking what seems like a personal question about your health, because I know that many years ago now you were diagnosed with a rare form of blood cancer. And we're given a dire diagnosis of only a few years to live, but you're obviously still with us and sounds like you're still thriving. So I wanted to find out, I wouldn't be able to pronounce the name of the disease, but I wanted to know how that's progressed.
Yeah, so I was diagnosed with Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia a while ago. And I think it was back in 2007.
Yes.
Yeah. And so they usually have about 5 or 6 or 7 years to live. So I'm still around and kicking, and people look at me and a lot of people always come up to me and say, how's your cancer doing? Didn't you have cancer? And they can't believe it, because I look at the same and I look healthier than a lot of people who don't have cancer. And so I've been gone through a series of drugs, and finding cancer is all about picking the right drugs and being lucky. And I happen to be lucky in that the one thing that wasn't lucky is my cancer is incurable, generally it's incurable, that there are very few people that are able to get the cancer eradicated, but it's a very slow moving cancer. And so the treatments are very good at slowing down a very slow cancer. And so, or basically stopping it from progressing. And so I've been on drug treatments that have arrested the progression of the cancer, and it's not like it's a blood cancer, and so as long as you keep it at bay, you're in good shape, and you can lead a very long life. And sometimes you get unlucky, and the cancer transforms. But if you're careful about the treatments that you select, and you get involved, and you get educated about what the alternatives are, and you insert yourself into the decision-making chain, I think you get better results. And so When I was diagnosed, there were a lot of alternatives, and I looked through the pros and cons of each alternative, and I was the one making the final decision in terms of which treatments that I would accept. And I didn't go for anything that was really, and I didn't do any of the strong chemo treatments because of the potential side effects down the road, and because of the possibility that the cancer could transform into something that would be more difficult to treat. Mm-hmm. And so I've taken a path of let's try the stuff that has the least side effects first, before we go and we march out the heavy artillery that has a lot of collateral damage. And I've been lucky enough to find drugs and, you know, pick paths that were successful for me. And that, that has kept my cancer at bay. So that's the quick story of that.
Well, that's great to hear. And I know that, you're a noted philanthropist. I know that you've also, done a lot to contribute to researching for that disease as well. So,
yeah. So, you know, help wherever we can. So that's, you know, where I feel I can make a difference to try to, get involved and, you know, pitch in. So,
well, Steve Kirch, thank you for coming on the podcast and, outlining what is really a remarkable, entrepreneurial career that as you've outlined, doesn't seem to be ending anytime soon. So, good luck on your future endeavors.
Thanks, Brian.
If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice. There's plenty more great internet history where that came from. And if you're a longtime listener, then you know what to do to help us out. Rate and review us on iTunes. Because iTunes gives credit to reviews and ratings, and the more great reviews we get, the more people will discover us. As always, there's more info on our website, www.internethistorypodcast.com. The show's Twitter handle is @NetHistoryPod, and my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.